Hello everyone, and welcome to minute 168 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me for this penultimate episode, which is the same episode that he's been on for 7 of the last 8 seasons, is Agent Palmer of the Palmer Files. Welcome back to the show, Papa Palmer.
Yeah, it's exciting to be here. It is. And this is probably I will say, you keep making me watch these films. And this one,
do anything. One second. You need to take that into consideration. You always have the option of saying, I don't want to be on your show this season. I don't like that
movie. I love being on your show. So in order to
be ordered, I don't force anyone to watch this or do anything they don't want to do.
In order to be on the show, which I love to do, I have to watch these films. And this one in particular,
it's preferable.
Okay. But if I would feel bad if I didn't do my homework. But anyway, I have watched this film before, okay? But I don't remember when or why, which makes it all the more odd that I remember that I watched its sister film in the theater, The Thin Red Line. So did I watch them? Did I watch Saving Private Ryan in the theater and forget and then see Thin Red Line? I don't remember. I've seen this before. And I do remember seeing The Thin Red Line in theaters. It's so odd to me.
That is very odd. I do agree with you on that. Now, tell me, are you a fan of The Thin Red Line or not?
I only watched it the one time and I don't remember. So I think at the time, because these came out in 96, right? Was it 96?
No, this came out in 98.
98. Okay. So I was 15, and so I think at the time both of these films were a bit over my head. Like, obviously 15, you're in high school, you're learning about World War II, and these, I think, to a lot of history teachers, both of the films that I just mentioned were very impactful in kind of getting across the message and like the realities of war.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, you know, watching it now, not just because of my new arrival, I don't think being a father has changed much, because every time I watch these films or World War II films in general, I think about my grandparents, because obviously they served. And I only got some stories from them, but I always put them in place. And so I think having watched it originally, like, it just went over my head. It's just a war movie. And I don't want to denigrate it, but like, it's just a war movie. You know, it's that thing that happened that I learned about in history class.
Okay. And that was 15-year-old Palmer.
Yes. Now I think about, like, you know, the performances in it and the ideas behind it. One of the things, so obviously, as you said at the top, I'm host of the Palmer Files, but I also edit the Good Government Show, and we have some sister shows called Leading Iowa, Good Government in Iowa Cities, and As Fate Would Have It. And the Iowa show, which is all about people talking about mayors talking about the things they're doing in and around Iowa, there's a bridge in Waterloo, Iowa, that is all about I'm going to get this wrong, it's because I've edited way too many of them. I think it's the Veterans Bridge, or it's a military memorial bridge. Okay. And it was in honor of it's not like a Saving Private Ryan situation, but there was an amount of brothers, or there were three brothers, I think, or
the
it's
Nealon
not
brothers.
Saving Private.
The Nealon brothers.
What?
The Nealon.
Yes.
Okay, the Nealon Brothers story. This story is based on the story of the Nealon Brothers.
So it is them.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So I, having heard about that, like, that was before I sat down to watch the film, and I kept thinking back to it, and it feels like.
I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I, you've seen Band of Brothers, right?
No.
Okay. Well, you gotta, you know, find 12 hours to sit and watch that. It's definitely worth it. Or maybe it's 10 hours. But again, it's just mind blowing, amazing. But earlier this week, you know, I had an interview with one of the sons of the guy from one of the guys from Band of Brothers, George Lewis Jr.
Okay.
And you know, he was talking about the fact that, that even the story of Band of Brothers is connected to the Nylund brothers, because one of the Nylund brothers was best friends with one of the guys in Easy Company, you know, so the whole thing. And that's partially also how both Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan got made, because their connections to the idea of the Nylund brothers. And it's like, hey, wait a second, let's do something similar, but you know, we're going to change it a little bit, you know, fictionalize it, as they say.
Yeah. But having like the real concrete like repercussions, you know, it's a different kind of heavier film, obviously, than I think I would normally sit down and watch. But my takeaway is really one of regret. I watched that might be just my reaction to all World War II films now. And that's because both my grandparents served and my grandfather served, and I never got real stories from them. And maybe it's the podcaster in me, but it's probably the storyteller in me. I just lament the loss of whatever those stories were. Now, granted, I know a lot of people from that generation didn't talk about what happened in the war.
Yes.
And I get that. But I never asked. You know what I mean? Like, I know it's too late now, they're gone, but like,
and your mother and father also never asked the same question?
No. Yeah, no. The only thing I have is from my dad's dad. I have some pictures from him and his time in the military. And so there's a picture of him in Algiers, and there's a picture of him in front of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. But all I have are those pictures. I don't have the stories that go along with them.
Okay.
And so while this is a great film, that's kind of where my mind wanders. You know, obviously he was part of the desert warfare, but it's all the same war. And so I do have this kind of missed opportunity to not know.
Okay, but again, there's nothing you can do to change that at this point, you know.
Yeah,
that's just the way it is, you know. I mean, you can maybe try and find information online or something like that, but it won't be the same as hearing the story from, excuse the expression, from the horse's mouth.
That's true. If he would even have, that either of them would have been forthcoming.
That's
a whole.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, again, we've talked about this so many times over the period of this entire season. Again, earlier this week, I had, you know, my hour and 45 minute interview with a World War II veteran who discussed all this stuff. You know, you don't get a chance very often to talk to a 101-year-old World War II veteran who is so lucid and knows and is able to retell his story, you know, after 80 years. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. We could all be so lucky to be so lucid at 100 plus.
Yeah, I figured out I'm exactly half his age, and he's probably more lucid than I am. You know, and I'm lucid. It's not that I'm not. You know.
I liked it. I really did. It's not, but again, as we'll get into when we get into our lists, or my lists, infantry stuff, like soldier stuff, is not usually my World War II cup of tea.
Okay. That's okay. It doesn't need to be. If everyone liked the same thing, life would be boring. For every single aspect in life or whatever it is. I use it when you talk about movies. If everyone loved the same movie, then it would just be really boring to talk about it. You want to have a little bit of a debate and a discussion with people about different things.
Yes.
Which that's one of the things that makes life so fun and interesting, that you have what to discuss with others.
100%.
And you don't have to agree on everything. You and I don't agree on everything either. We've had our debates in the past on various subjects and stuff like that. We don't agree, and that's fine, but we can still be friends.
I will find a way to disagree with people because it's more fun that way.
You see, I only disagree with people if I really need to disagree with them. I don't play games by trying to find reasons to disagree. Whatever. I do have a diverse, I'm a very opinionated person. So yes, I will have arguments with people, but I choose my debates, wisely. I don't want to waste my time debating someone about something that, that A, I don't care about, or B, it's just going to be really boring. That's the
thing. Whereas I will pick a fight with my best friend for the heck of it, because it's been 20 years and it's always fun to just, it's like chess. Yeah. It's verbal chess for us. So, a little bit of fun.
That's fair. That is fair. All right. So, bottom line, are you happy that you rewatched the movie or not?
I am, actually. I am. I think it's different because it's not quite like, maybe It's a Wonderful Life. It's not.
Duh.
I think based. But no.
It's black and white. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No. But based on a true story makes it, it's just a little different, right?
This isn't based on a true story either, and neither is It's a Wonderful Life. So you've got to put yourself in the corner.
Fine. As someone who, since I last watched this film, has read a ton of World War II nonfiction based solely on the Battle of Britain, it was interesting to finally be back on the ground again.
Okay.
How about that?
It's always nice to ground Palmer. That's what it comes down to. All right. I like that. I'm fine with that. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Excellent. So minute 168 begins with the sound department credits and ends with the movie's copyright. So you see, you're actually the first person that gets to really talk about credits on this season, because the last 4 days I've had interviews with people and didn't talk about, the credits, because there were people who really wouldn't have anything to talk about when it comes to that. No, they had a lot to talk about Saving Private Ryan and World War II, but not the credits of the movie.
I'll start with this. I don't know exactly where it is in the minute, but I was not shocked in hindsight, right? In the last year, 6 months, year, there was a great John Williams documentary that came out. Yes,
there was.
And because of that documentary, when Boston Symphony Orchestra and Tanglewood Chorus came up, when those two came up, I was like, well, of course they would. Those are like second homes to John Williams. Why wouldn't he go to where he knows?
That's right.
And that was very exciting to see, actually, because he was like the longest tenured, like Boston Pops, Boston Symphony, conductor.
Was he?
Has he been supplanted now?
First of all, he has been supplanted. He was replaced a while ago. But
not for longest tenured. He's still the longest tenured.
No, but he's not. He's not the.
Well, he's not there anymore. Well, I know he's not the Meister anymore. I'm saying he was the longest tenured one, though.
Mm-hmm.
He was. I think he was there for like 17 years or something like that.
All right. So, we're skipping a little ahead, but we'll do that for you. All right. So, first of all, they've had 17 different music directors of the Boston Symphony Orchestra since it was instituted. Do you know what year they founded the Boston Symphony Orchestra?
I want to say like 1890 something.
And you are so close. It's great. It's 1881. So there you go.
Wow. Okay. Okay. All and right. So one of the things is the most famous before John Williams. Okay. And this kind of relates to
one second, but you see, there's music. Two different things here. You have the Boston Pops and you have the Boston Symphony Orchestra. So right now we're talking about the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
You know, well,
the Boston Pops is sort of a branch. Yeah.
And I can't think of his name now, but there's Fiedler, I think, was also in charge before John Williams of Arthur Fiedler. I don't remember. My brain's going, was also in charge of the Boston Pops and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And he did a lot of, Americana Star Spangled Banner type albums with the Boston Pops.
Yes. It's Arthur Fiedler.
Okay. And those did very well. And I only bring it up because I inherited a record collection and I ended up listening to some of those albums. And while they're not obviously as somber as the music of Saving Private Ryan, there is a connection in that the music that John Williams did for this film is very, it has those uplifting moments that are kind of stolen from the Americana that Fiedler, he didn't invent, but he refined.
Right. Okay. When did they start the idea of the Boston Pops? Because we had the Boston Symphony Orchestra was in 1881.
I mean, the Boston Pops has to be like 1925.
1885.
It took them four years.
Okay. Before 1930, they had 17 different conductors of the Boston Pops. Okay. So between 1885 and 1930, a period of 45 years, they had 17 different conductors. In 1930, Arthur Fiedler became the conductor. Okay. Yep. And he remained the conductor for more than 50 years.
Okay.
So John Williams doesn't come anywhere close.
No.
He has many years of being the conductor because Fiedler died in 1979 and he was succeeded by John Williams, who was the conductor until 1995. Okay. Yep. And then,
which means he's still got all his connections when he goes to do Saving Private
Ryan. Yeah, for sure. And the conductor since 1995 is Keith Lockhart. So therefore, the current conductor has been there for 20 years, and John Williams was only there for, I think, 13 or 14 years. So okay. Of the three that we've just mentioned,
yeah, he's
John Williams is there the least amount of time. But that's fine. Yeah. I mean, he's obviously the most well-known with the Boston Pops, and he still does – I don't know if he still does today, but up until recently, he was still doing – guest appearances as the conductor.
Yeah. And then there's the Tanglewood Festival Chorus.
That is correct. The Tanglewood Festival Chorus, which I had never heard of before going into this. Do you know how, okay, so what year do you think they started the Tanglewood Festival Chorus?
Oh, I want to say it's 1944.
1970.
Oh, that's a lot more recent than I would have expected.
So the idea was that they wanted to add in, you know, some people singing a little bit in the whole thing. And so the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, how many people do you think they currently have in, as part of their entourage, I guess you can say?
All right. Well, I mean, at least four, because you need what, an alto, a soprano, a tenor, and a bass. I'm going to go with 35, 36.
There are over 200 singers who are part of the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, and they usually every performance has anywhere between 90 and 120 singers.
Wow.
When they have the Christmas festival stuff that was known as the Christmas Pops, they usually have 50 singers on each show. And therefore, basically any one of these members of the Tanglewood Festive Chorus usually appear in only 9 to 11 Christmas performances each year.
Okay.
Because it's broken down through that whole thing. But I mean, again, those numbers are just unbelievable. And from what I understand, it's almost entirely voluntary. You know, they're not getting paid.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yes, it is. So yes, the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Tanglewood Festival Chorus are mentioned here, which is great. You know, they let us know that they're. I mean, what's funny is you sort of jumped a little ahead. You only jumped ahead 7 seconds, but you know, up until then, we basically had most of the sound department and stuff like that, which I think is really cool because you know this movie won two Oscars dealing with sound. So you know the fact that you know we haven't talked about any of the credits in the last four episodes, and we just you know fall on the end of the credits, and the first we come across is the sound department, which ended up taking home two Oscars.
It's so easy to skip over that only because I don't want to skip ahead too much, but like when you get into the ILM of it, Industrial Light and Magic, I know, and I don't know why I know this, because I know that they did a lot of practical effects.
Yes, they did.
And I know that when they do practical effects, at least, you know, what they try to do is they try and get mics on all of those practical effects, if possible.
That's true.
And so the Foley is maybe as hard as the job that ILM has in terms of making it blend. So you don't obviously in most movies it Foley exists and you don't know what's real through the microphone and what's real through a sound thing. And the same is true for effects like in this film where you don't know what's practical and you don't know what's added and this, that, and the other thing. But the Foley in this film, like I have no idea what it is because I just assume that every time they shot a rifle, they had a microphone on that.
Again,
I'm
it's
just guessing.
very possible that I don't know. I didn't get a chance to speak to anybody who worked on the technical aspects of the film. I did talk to an actor who was in the film. He talked about some of the cool stuff that happened there. Everyone who's been listening has already also heard. I had an interview with one of the guys from ILM, which ran for a little over an hour, and he was talking about a lot of stuff that they were doing. He wasn't dealing with the sound stuff. Uh,
Okay,
he,
yeah.
he was dealing more with matte paintings and stuff like that. But
But this is also, I mean, to go back to the Foley, this is another, I don't know if it ties in. This is another Skywalker sound credit.
yes.
It felt like I mean I can't speak. Maybe it's just the movies I watch. I can't remember a film that wasn't mixed in Skywalker sound. Maybe that just says something about the films I watch, but just for some reason it's just like, and so like I know someone who used to do Foley for Skywalker Sound or at Skywalker Sound, and they were doing all the Marvel stuff, and it's just like that's fine, but before that, you know, you stay through the credits and you go, oh, there's another Skywalker sound, there's another, you know, it's just I think they were the big name. They still are the big
Yeah,
name.
of course. Yeah, there's no question about that. Basically, as you know, we continue through the credits, we get to the visual effects. Obviously, you know, as you mentioned earlier, we get to talk, we get to see all of the IMDb. I love how there's like a really large I guess space between, you know, the executive in charge of music and the special visual
I'll
effects guy,
say
Industrial Light and Magic, is really to emphasize it.
the credits on this, the credits, based on where we are in the credits are spaced maybe unlike any other film. Where like it's almost like they wait for one, they don't quite wait for everything else, like all the sound people to get off the screen before they start the next
That's
one,
right.
but they almost do.
Right.
And it's I've never seen that in a credits before.
Well, I wonder if Spielberg does that in other movies. I wonder if like Schindler's List would be done this way, or Jurassic Park and things like that. I don't know. I haven't gone through them.
Yeah.
So
Yeah,
it
it is
could
odd.
be.
I mean, I'm it's weird now because ILM was still, I guess they were a massive outfit at this point. I
Yeah,
feel
they were
like.
definitely massive by 98. I mean, again, ILM started in 77 or 76 with Star Wars. So here we're
Yeah.
talking 22 years later. There's
Industrial
nobody
light,
who
yeah.
knows them. Most of the companies around doing various visual effects are either people who've left ILM or just been inspired by them. One of the two. I will always remember, and this is just so funny because when I remember watching the credits of Titanic. Okay,
Okay.
and there they had a whole bunch of different special effects companies doing various parts of it and stuff like that. And I still remember I had the two tape VHS of it, and I remember
Yep.
watching the credits and just looking at the names of the various companies. And then one of them is I think if I remember correctly, they were called Band from the Ranch.
Okay.
Okay, now everyone knows that ILM and Skywalker Sound and all that stuff, they basically are on a Skywalker Ranch. And the so
Yes.
it means it's the people who got kicked out of ILM or left for whatever reasons, they started their own company and they called it Band from the Ranch. Just
That takes some
big cojones.
weight. Yeah.
Yeah, I
You
agree.
don't need to see my resume. You just need to know that I was banned from the ranch.
That's right. That's right.
Also, since we're on the digital stuff, like I will say you can't really tell what was what. You know, and this isn't like, and we'll get to this because it's a Spielberg thing and it was gonna come up, obviously. It's not like Jurassic Park where like you can kinda tell what is like a puppet, like a physical effect versus the brontosaurus, which is your brachiosaurus, which is digital. Like and so in this I can guess, I can at best I can guess where the digital is. But because I know they used so much practical, I have no idea what's what. Like and I think that's how they do that. That's how they know they did a good job, is that
Correct.
you don't know
That is
what's what. And I give Jurassic Park a pass because it was 93 and it was still new. But by 98, if anything stuck out, they would have failed in some
right.
way,
No, but
right? Because
there's
by
another
now,
difference
there's no.
also because Jurassic Park, they're dealing with elements that don't really exist. This movie, everything exists.
No, I get
So
that, but I also can't. I think like the real T-Rex, I think, is practical, even though it's not real. You know what I mean? Like the T-Rex they put on a truck
okay,
or to move it around.
but the T-Rex that they put on a truck or to move around, okay, anyone who is watching or rewatching Jurassic Park is going to be forgiving them, for little slight mistakes and stuff like that. When it comes to something like Saving Private Ryan, if there's a visual effect that doesn't work, people are going to look at that and go, oh, that just doesn't look real, from that perspective.
Well, I guess and to your point of this is, 27 years ago, there are still World War II veterans that will go to this movie at that time.
Yes.
And it may not be glaring to you and me,
Oh, for sure, for sure, for
but
sure.
I think there's definitely an amount of like extra work that went in for authenticity in order to make sure that not only did they do them proud, but they wouldn't be like, well, there weren't lasers. I mean, they
Yeah,
wouldn't do
for
anything
sure.
so brazen, but something just as simple as that. And just the sheer fact that it feels like a documentary.
Okay, and one of the things that got me, I mean, you're talking about the fact that you know you try to figure out what's real and what are real effects and what are visual effects or practical effects and visual effects. You know, so when I talked a few weeks ago, probably like a month and a half ago, with Corey Johnson, you know, who's an actor in the movie, you know, I always believed up until my conversation with him that the scene where we see him dead and he is the radio man whose face gets caved in. Okay. All right. So I always believed that that was a visual effect. And he was the first, I mean, he told me that that was, they pulled me out of that trench and threw a dummy in there in my place. And it was a dummy. And I'm like, oh my God, that's a practical effect. You know, it just blew me away. And so, anyone who's interested can go back and listen to his episodes, 131, 132, 135. Those are the three, where he was on. And I mean, he talked about a lot of the stuff that, you know, when he's there on the set and he sees, you know, the way that they're doing these practical effects, and he's, you know, an established actor, and especially now, you know, he's looking back and he's like, wow, it's just amazing the number of practical effects that they did in this movie to make everything so authentic and real.
That's it. It's kind of a, I don't know, a point of pride, I think, with Spielberg in general, of just if he can get away with doing the practical, he still will.
Yes.
And who's going to tell him no?
Nobody. Nobody, nobody, nobody. Okay, so then we start going through the various credits of the visual effects, and you know, at that 26-second mark, we actually get to see right in the middle of the screen the visual effects editor Bill Kimberlin, who was my guest just yesterday. So it's always fun. He missed it by 26 seconds. You know, the minute of that he could talk about. You know, that he would be talking within his minute, but on the other hand, you know, we can actually now talk about the fact, we can mention the fact that he was in, you know, that he's listed there and stuff like that. So that's just really cool. I mean, again, they go through all the various ILM people, and there are tons here. You know, I'm not even gonna try to go through any of them.
It's a lot for its time as well. Like there, I think even for the late 90s, like, and again, maybe it's a Spielberg thing, but like this is an amount of visual editors and visual effects people that I would expect on Phantom Menace. Like, you know what I mean? Just the amount of them. It's an obscene amount of people for what I assume is maybe the blending of the physical and the digital because of what the story you just told, but like everything else of how much they did in practical.
Correct. This is so true. Right before we get to the next part of the credits itself, so there was something that jumped out at me, and I'm assuming that you have this in just about every movie. But I've never paid attention to this before. Have you ever heard of the color timer?
No.
Okay, so the color timer for this movie is a man named Dale Grahn, Grahn. Okay, and I mean, he has lots and lots. He has 282 credits in the editorial department. You know, so he's been pretty busy most of his career. You know, no question about that. And so I just was curious, what does a color timer do? So a color timer works to correct or properly adjust the color of each shot, which can be a very long and daunting task. Traditionally, films are made up of several thousand small snippets that are pieced or spliced together to make up the production. So again, that's just
All right, so I have a okay, so I have to skip ahead so I can ask this question. How did he do his job? And I asked that
because of the fact that
because
the movie is the color is saturated.
no, I say that because later in the credits it says that this movie was edited on a moviola, which is a physical film editor thing. So like th this according to the credits, and maybe it was just a part of it was filmed on a movie, was edited on a moviola, but they made a big deal later in the credits that we'll get to which we'll talk about now, that says it's edited on Moviola, which is a physical, like, I have two reels of whatever and I'm putting it together. And so to me, that feels like this was a physical film that was edited, and this guy's got a digital, like, it,
it's not digital. That's the thing. It's the color timer uses a machine called a color analyzer that works to balance the color of each scene and adjust the brightness in a way that makes the movie appear continuous and as though it was filmed on the same reel.
Okay, so it is based on physical film.
Yes. Right, and this is,
okay.
This, if so I maybe... remember correctly, this is the final Oscar winner that was not done, that was not edited on in a digital way. You know, that was still done.
Yeah, because I had to look up, I had to look up the Moviola, because I was like, I think I know what that is, but I don't know what that is. But it is odd. 1998, well, 76, whenever he's editing this. I guess it makes sense. Like, it puts, it's kind of like you put it on film because it gives it a different feel.
Yeah.
But just kind of, Steven, it's 1998. Come on.
Yes. But what's really cool, if you read this article that I have that talks about what a color timer does, and it says additional skills include ability to work with others, ability to understand the overall creative desire of the director, strong understanding of color, hues, saturation, contrast, and film color balance, ability to work well under pressure and meet deadlines, ability to adjust film color so as to capture accurate skin tones, scene backgrounds, and other set items that could be misinterpreted if the coloring is inaccurate, and knowledge of color grading software and video editing.
He definitely got the direction right, because this film is not outside of the first and last scene in the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a specific tone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So he got it right.
Yeah.
I'm going to say.
For sure. All right, so then the credits continue, and we get into the songs, which they basically only give us three. We have Solitude, which is the first, which is the opening and closing themes of this season's episodes. Thank you once again to David Brooke for giving us those musical interludes, and then we have the two Edith Piaf songs that we've talked about. You know, during those minutes, and that's it. You know, there's no other songs that are mentioned here.
Yeah. There's a couple things that blow my mind here, and I had to do some, like, extra homework here. There are only three songs mentioned. Fair enough. But it still says the soundtrack is available on whatever, okay?
On DreamWorks Records.
And this is the thing. So this is the thing that I'm always amazed by, right? Because technically, that's a score, because it's all of John Williams' original stuff. None of these three songs, well, Solitude, I think, but like the Edith Piaf songs don't make it on the soundtrack.
Because there was no room for them after
the soundtrack. When you look,
you know, all the John Williams tracks.
Yeah, and but at the same time, now I know now, because it's changed recently. Now, like a Marvel movie will say that you can get the score and the soundtrack available on CD or albums or whatever. But back then, it was just a soundtrack and it was just the score, which was a bit weird to me.
I remember as a kid, you know, you could get the soundtrack and it would have like all the songs in the movie, and it would add the opening and closing titles. You know, that's what they would usually have on there. And then obviously there were movies like Star Wars and stuff like that where you can get just the entire musical score where most of it is also cut out. You know, that's why they were able to keep putting out more and more albums. You know, because there was just so much that wasn't used that they couldn't fit on to the original one.
Yeah. Yeah. But three songs, like, even still, might be the least amount of music I've ever seen in a credit.
That's right. I would definitely agree with you on that.
Yeah. But if anybody knows one with anything less, please let us know. Yeah. I'd be curious.
Yes, I would be curious also. And then it says produced with the support of investment incentives for the Irish film industry provided by the government of Ireland, which is a little strange.
There's a lot of Ireland in the credits, in the filming, yeah. in the thank yous. There's a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And then we go through all the thank yous, which we're not going to go through them. And there are about 20 different people and places listed here, you know, for that they want to be thanked. I don't know if you went into detail on any of them. I just looked at them and nothing really.
The only one that stood out for me was the Clooney family.
No, it's the Clooney family. It's not Clooney. That would be missing an O. For me, the craziest thing here was the you know, that they have thanks to Fruit of the Loom. I mean, there's nobody running around here in their underwear. So, you know, maybe the t-shirts that the guys were wearing or something like that.
It stood out for me, but then I went like, did I miss an underwear scene? Like, I just
there was no gratuitous underwear scene, you know, in this movie.
No.
You know, they didn't even like strip down Steamboat Willie and you know, things like that. So I don't know. It's just it just was very strange that is, you know, what's mentioned here. You know, Fruit of the Loom. No clue whatsoever.
You know,
unless they provided underwear for all the extras.
it's a boon for Fruit of the Loom. It's a bane for Haynes. I don't know.
Seriously, completely. We get the next credit, which basically says filmed on location in England, Ireland, and France. And then, as you said, we get the edited on the Moviola.
Yeah. Seriously, though, Steven, it's 1998. What are you doing? Like.
Exactly.
Come on.
And then basically this minute ends with the copyright of 1998, which I'm glad they got right because, you know, I've done movies, which they did. And that's pretty much everything I have to say about this minute. Did you have anything else that you wanted to discuss that we possibly missed?
No, I think we got it all.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. So now we will go through the five daily segments, even though today is Thursday. So should we start with Thursday and then go back to the others?
Start with Thursday. Okay. Yeah.
We'll start with Thursday. So Thursday's segment is Say What Thursday. It's the game that we get to play.
Here we go.
That's right. So I will give a quote from an actor in this movie and tell you what year they made this quote, and you have to tell me what movie it is. All right? So, but to make it a little bit easier, it's either going to be a movie with Paul Giamatti, Matt Damon, or Tom Hanks. Okay, I decided I would go a little easy on you with this. You know, so it's one of those three. All right. Every one of these that I'm going to say, these are obviously real movie quotes from one of these three actors. It could be that I don't go to, you know, I don't have to use all three of them. You know, some one of them or two of them could be red herrings. You never know. Okay.
Okay.
So there's no guarantee that I will be using all of them.
So it's Giamatti, Hanks, or
Matt Damon.
Damon.
Right. And so I'll give you a quote, and you have to tell me what movie it is. You know, it's relatively
simple. Okay.
All right. We'll start with an easy one. We'll throw a softball at you. Okay. So from 1994, and the quote is, "Mama always said dying was part of life. I sure wish it wasn't."
Okay. That's Tom Hanks. That's Forrest Gump.
That is correct. See, it's not so difficult.
Okay.
Okay.
See, he says that because he just gave me the softball.
Right. Okay. The next one. Again, it could be Paul Giamatti, Matt Damon, or Tom Hanks. 1992. And the quote is, "I gave away 5 years at the end of my career drinking. 5 years. And now there isn't anything I wouldn't give to get back any one day of it." 1992.
I don't even know the film. I can't place. I'm thinking it's Giamatti.
And you would be wrong.
It's Hanks?
It is Hanks, yes. So what movie was Tom Hanks in 1992 that it could be?
I have no idea. It wasn't Bonfire of the Vanities, was it?
No, that was 91.
That wasn't 92.
That was 91, but...
Okay. I have no idea.
Think about
I can't
a character that he's playing that would have talked about.
Oh, was that Philadelphia?
That he was getting drunk.
Was that
Philadelphia?
That
93.
Wasn't Philadelphia, was it?
That it was not Philadelphia.
Oh. Okay, so I've gone on either side now.
That's correct.
Hone it in.
I gave you this one because I know that you like this type of character's profession.
Was this a League of Their Own?
Yes, it is. It's a League of Their Own. There you go.
Wow. Apparently, it's been a long time since I've watched a League of Their Own.
Apparently. Okay, next one from 1988. Well, there's a million robots that turn into something, and this is a building that turns into a robot. So what's fun about playing with a building? That's not any fun.
That's Hanks from Big.
That is correct. There you go. See, you're doing well. All right.
Okay.
1995. From now on, we live in a world where man has walked on the moon, and it's not a miracle. We just decided to go.
Yeah, that's Hanks from Apollo 13.
Okay. See, you're doing really well. And the final one from 1999. A big man is ripping your ears off, Percy. I do as he says. Could be Tom Hanks, Matt Damon, or Paul Giamatti.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot easier when I didn't have Matt Damon to consider because he was too young for all those other roles.
Yeah, that is one of the problems with this game from that perspective, yes.
Yeah.
I do
agree. I don't know the film. I really don't.
1999. Think of a character named Percy who's getting his ears ripped off.
Wait, was it Matt Damon in Dogma?
No. And Dogma was in 98, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe it was
2001. All right.
I see, now I don't remember what your Dogma was.
Might be 97 even.
Sorry. Dogma was 99. I apologize. There you go. But it is not Dogma.
Okay. Is it Hanks?
Yes, it is. What movie was he in 1999 that he would have talked to a character named Percy?
That wasn't Toy Story, was it?
Nope.
Is that Toy Story?
No, Toy Story was 95. Toy Story 2 was 99, but that's not it either.
I genuinely don't know.
Okay, it's based.
We're starting to get into my dead
selling novel. With Tom Hanks right, as the lead character.
With that clue, is it no, it's not Angels and Demons. That's the sequel.
No, Angels and Demons came out in 2009, and Da Vinci Code came out in 2006. So we can take those out.
So it's not Da Vinci Code. All right. No. Oh, I have no idea.
Okay, it is based on a best-selling horror novel.
Yeah, that doesn't help me.
Okay, the author is Stephen King. Tom Hanks movie? What movie was Tom Hanks in that was based on a Stephen King novel?
I don't know. Horror's not like horror's. I'm worse at horror than I am at World War II movies.
Well, it's not really horror. That's the thing.
Okay. But I don't know.
It has a color in the title.
I have no idea. I genuinely don't know.
And
I got nothing.
And it's 20 minutes longer than this movie. The answer is The Green Mile.
Is it really? I didn't know that was based off of a Stephen King for some reason. And I don't think I've
seen it. And now you know. Now you know. Okay.
All right. Now I know.
Let's now go to the Monday segment. Maestro Monday, where you're now going to give me your top five John Williams themes. And I know you told me you're going to be cheating, so I'm assuming that this is where you're first going to start your cheating, but who knows.
This is the first cheat. Number five. Okay, the first four I think are in descending order. My number one's Jurassic Park.
But why are you
my number two
one?
Is Indiana.
Go start with number five and work your way up.
We're going to build up because I don't think anybody's going to argue.
Wait,
until I get
up
to four.
You're,
and five,
you're building down, you're saying.
We're building down.
Okay. Jurassic Park.
My number one's Jurassic. Yep. My number two is Indiana Jones.
Okay.
And my number three is Star Wars. Okay. I think that's personal preference. Nobody's going to argue there.
No.
Right. Number four for me, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Okay.
I love Close Encounters. I love everything about it. It's probably going to appear again. Shocker, right? But my number five, and I thought about this. My number five is a theme that has been in a lot of movies, but it is not a movie theme. And that is the Olympic fanfare.
Okay, yeah, it has been used before, so you're fine with that.
Because
you're fine with that cheat.
It is, I know I will not argue against how pivotal Jaws is as a movie score, but it's not my favorite.
Okay.
So, there it is. Those are my five.
Okay, that's fair. Again, you know, we have one other person that has used the Olympic fanfare. Sorry, two that have used Olympic fanfare. So you're okay. Good.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
All right. Excellent. So the next one we will do is Tom Hanks Tuesday, where you will give your top five Tom Hanks performances.
My number five is The Circle.
Really?
Because as great actors playing like bad tech evil tech moguls, I guess. Hanks's role in The Circle is up there for me as a performance with Tim Robbins as the evil Bill Gates character in Antitrust.
Okay.
And I know a lot of people are so on Antitrust, but like, to me, Tim Robbins as an evil Bill Gates in Antitrust is one of the best like evil tech villains I've ever seen. And when I saw The Circle, I think Tom Hanks got close to that kind of evil thing. I never read the books. The Circle that it's based off. I only ever watched the movie, but like, I think Hanks as the villain in that, spoiler alert, the villain.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it.
I really enjoyed that. So that's my number five.
Okay, fair enough.
Number four, You've Got Mail. I'm not the biggest rom-com kind of guy, but there's something about, and maybe it's hindsight, it could be hindsight, but there's something about the way that You've Got Mail kind of works, where maybe in hindsight, it's kind of creepy, that kind of a email relationship.
There are a lot of creepy things in that movie.
There are, but I don't know. There's something, I don't know. I liked it. I liked it.
Okay.
That's, you know. Number three is probably the most modern film of his that I've watched and really enjoyed is A Man Called Otto. I think his performance in that, I think it might be the most un-Hanks like character he's ever done.
I really loved him. When he played Tom Parker, was it Colonel Tom Parker in Elvis, I think is the craziest, where he just doesn't look like Tom Hanks.
But I really liked him in A Man Called Otto. Okay. So, that's my three. Number two, Forrest Gump. I think that for anyone who has to play a character across ages/decades, that's never an easy thing. And it's just really good. And then number one, which came up during the quiz, Apollo 13. Tom Hanks as Jim Lovell.
Why does that not surprise me?
not a shock at all.
No, not at all. But that's okay. That's perfectly okay. All right. Excellent. So now we will move on to Wednesday segment, World War II Wednesday, where you will now give me your top five World War II movies.
First, my honorable mention is The Battle of Britain from like 1960.
Nine. I think it's nine.
Yeah,
I believe it's nine, but
okay. The old one. I think they've kind of made a few other ones in their documentaries, but
with Michael Caine and Trevor Howard.
Yep. So that's the honorable mention, because I wanted to mention it. Number five was Stalag 17.
Ooh.
And I only ever watched this film because it was credited as the like unofficial origin story for Hogan's Heroes.
It's not unofficial. It is. That's where it came from.
It is. Okay. Yeah. So that's why it makes the list. Yes. Number four is Schindler's List. Number three is The Great Escape.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Number two is Strategic Air Command. Because, which is the second time I think I've talked about this movie.
Well, come on.
In two appearances.
There you go.
Because it's got Jimmy Stewart, but it's Jimmy Stewart kind of portraying Ted Williams, which is, as a baseball guy, that's kind of, you know, fun.
Yes.
And number one, my favorite World War II film is Memphis Belle. I have a soft spot in for that film in my heart. And that's kind of why, like, between the Battle of Britain's Strategic Air Command and Memphis Belle, and if you include the high-flying motorcycle of The Great Escape, a lot of my World War II films
take place off the ground.
In the air. Yes.
Okay, and that's fine. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. that's a great list. I really like that list.
All right. What's left?
We have the tomorrow's segment, Friday segment, which is Filmmaker Friday.
Yes. Oh, by the way, I have to thank you.
You're welcome.
Because I was curious, like, how much harder would this list be if you said producer Spielberg?
Ooh.
And I just looked at his producer credits and I went, this would be impossible. If it was producer Spielberg credits, it's hard enough as director Spielberg credits.
Yes.
But in descending order, number five, Ready Player One. I loved the book. I think I read the book in one sitting. I couldn't put it down either.
I loved Ready Player One.
And
I'm still struggling with the second one for like 2.5 years. You know.
I liked the second one. I actually think Armada.
I love Armada.
Is better than Ready Player Two. But I think it's equal to Ready Player One. But I think Ready Player One, the movie, given the limitations on copyright, I think Spielberg did as the best work anybody could have done with that film.
Okay.
Because you were never going to get the copyrights for everything mentioned in the book.
That's right.
And so I think what he was able to put together was wonderful.
Okay.
Number four, I wanted to include something of Spielberg's younger, his work for younger audiences. And so number four on my list is Hook, because while when we talk about like producer Spielberg, we get to talk about like Land Before Time and Tiny Toons and Animaniacs and like all this other stuff he did. But Hook was really like, I think my first non-animated Spielberg that was kind of aimed at me.
Interesting.
You know, okay. As a younger person.
Okay.
So I like that. Number three is my Indiana Jones include, which is The Last Crusade. Because I think I like Raiders better, but from a directing standpoint, I can only imagine it was not the easiest thing in the world to have those two stars on screen at the same time. And so from just a director perspective, having those two together and having to deal with whatever egos that may have entailed, that feels like the better director thing.
Okay, fair enough.
Number two, Close Encounters.
Why does that not surprise me? It's on this list.
I still think Close Encounters gets overshadowed by Star Wars, in that everybody forgot Close Encounters existed once Star Wars had a second film.
Well, that
like
makes
maybe
sense,
we can
though.
go. But I think Close Encounters is as timeless as the other stuff he's done.
Okay.
I really do. And then I Jurassic Park is number one for me. He brought that book alive, which is probably the reason I liked what he did with Ready Player One. I think Spielberg may be my number one director for moving for bringing something from the page to the screen.
Okay.
I know there's other screenwriters and other people involved, but as a director, I think he's one of my favorite from page to screen. So
very cool. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that.
Absolutely.
All right. So is there anything else you want to mention about this movie and about me forcing you to rewatch it?
I just want to know, like, oh man, in a future season, can I do like the penultimate episode at like, I don't know, maybe minute 93? Like, do we have any, are there any shorter films?
First of all, you've done that. Okay. You did win Harry Met Sally, which was a shorter one.
Was it?
Yes. When Harry Met Sally was 96 minutes, if I remember correctly. And you didn't want to be a part of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, you know.
It was a scheduling thing. We just couldn't get it
93 together. Episodes. See, there you go.
Okay. So that I missed. I missed
what,
the
wait,
one.
Wait,
that'll
second,
be
one
my...
second. So, but you know, for the next season, which I'm not announcing yet what it is, you will actually be on twice for two penultimate episodes. One is a pseudo penultimate, and the other is a full penultimate. You know, the season will only have 47 episodes, but the movie has more. So what can I tell you?
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. No, I think it was kind of interesting to, it was fun to rewatch. And I say that maybe a little melancholy, but because it's obviously not like a, you know, a happy film. I mean, it kind of is, it's not my minute, but like, I'm still a little concerned. Like, if my grandfather was walking ahead of me in a graveyard, I probably wouldn't let him walk. Like, if he got down on one knee, I'd be calling 911. I wouldn't be just running over to him. And I don't know. Ryan's family needs some, anyway. No, I really enjoyed it. It was good to kind of revisit it in some capacity. I think now I have to rewatch Thin Red Line, just because it's funny, like, we've all watched movies that we've forgotten about.
Yeah, of course.
Or like I watched that, but I don't remember much of it. You know, like those kind of things. And I was looking.
Think of who you're talking to.
I know I was in the theater. Okay, that's fair. But I was like, I know I'm in the theater. Like, who was in that movie? And I looked at the cast of Thin Red Line, which is almost A-list for A-list, as good as the cast of Saving Private Ryan. And I went, all right, well, now I gotta.
Yeah, but in all fairness, I've mentioned this. I'm not a fan of the Thin Red Line because I'm not a fan of Terrence Malick stuff. I find his work to be too esoteric and the
okay.
You know, I love Tarantino type nonlinear stuff. I hate Malick nonlinear stuff because it makes it confuses me. You know, it's he's one of those directors that just confuses me. Most of his movies are just not for me. But okay, that's me. You know,
I don't remember. That's the thing. I don't remember.
See,
so I don't have
I remember
a,
I've
opinion.
Seen it like two or three times, and every single time I was just completely confused. You know, that's what it came down to.
Okay.
So, but that's me. You know, you're more of an intellectual than I am. So maybe you'll be able to get more out of it. I don't know.
Or maybe I'll get even less.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing after you do find some time to watch it and see it. But if you do want to watch an excellent World War II thing, you gotta watch Band of Brothers. And there's 10 episodes and each one's an hour, but I have a feeling that you're gonna watch like one and you're gonna be like, oh my God, I can't not watch the next one. You know, that type of thing. I
Okay.
think you should try to at least invest the time watching the first two episodes and then decide from that if you want to keep going, because it's just amazing.
Okay. Well, I can always pencil it in as like a 10 weeks. I can go back to, like, here's the thing. I'm not against weekly viewing
Okay,
of
that's fine.
anything.
I have a feeling though that you're not going to manage watching it one a week. That's what I think. But I could be
Okay.
wrong.
Well,
I could be wrong. Even
I'll see what I can do, although
when they
I
aired it
don't.
on HBO, they aired two episodes every week. So
Okay. Well, I don't think I have enough time between now and when we'll be on again, but I will make an attempt.
okay, you do that. You do that. So, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, I have a blog where occasionally I talk a lot about books. Occasionally I talk about movies and television shows and music, and that's agentpalmer.com. And then occasionally or every other week, I guess, every 2 weeks, I put out a podcast where I trying to bring back things like you just heard, long form conversation. And Rob was on twice way back when, it feels like, although I don't think it was that long
Was a little
ago.
over a year ago.
And that's,
It was I think it
and
was about 13 months ago as of today. Something
okay,
like that.
so that is. That's the PalmerFiles.com or wherever you're listening to this now. And other than that, yeah, I'm just writing and recording. That's what I do.
Okay. Sounds like fun. And finding
Usually
that's
is.
right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to shoot me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So I'm just so excited. Tomorrow is the finale of this season. It will be on D-Day. So I hope everyone will come back tomorrow for D-Day itself. And then tomorrow I will potentially reveal what season 9 will be, which will begin on this coming Monday. So everyone, ha hold on to your hats and come back tomorrow. Hold on to your helmets, I guess you could say. Come back tomorrow and hear me and my good friend Jay Clewitt, closing out this season. And until then, earn this.
Earn this.
My solitude, you reveries of days gone by.